Welcome to today's Innovative Ideas podcast. Our guest today is James P. Pinkerton, contributor to the Fox News Channel and a regular panelist on the Fox News Watch show. He also writes regularly for foxnews.com and is the editor of seriousmedicinestrategy.org. In addition, Jim is a senior fellow at the New America Foundation and worked in the White House on domestic policy issues in the offices of Presidents Ronald Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush, as well as a consultant on the 1980, 84, 88, and 92 presidential campaigns. Jim, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Jim, one of your posts on your Serious Medicine Strategy blog, which I recommend to everyone to read it, was observation on a recent comment that Michelle Bachmann made on Fox News. And I'll just quote her very briefly here. She said, "In the midst of all the talk about facts and figures and insurance policies, we can't forget humanity. I want to see us focus on finding cures as well. Cures for Alzheimer's, cures for diseases that particularly deal with senior citizens, diabetes, for instance. That's what we need to do." She's onto something there, isn't she?
I think she is. I think she's brought up the kind of central failing of both the left and the right as they've thought about healthcare policy in the last two decades, which is the core issue, both in terms of our personal well-being and the financial fiscal well-being of the country, is not finance, it's health itself. Alzheimer's is expensive, whether it's Barack Obama paying for it or Paul Ryan paying for it. So the only hope to really make a dent in expenditures on serious illness is medical breakthroughs, medical transformations. It's shifting the paradigm, as it were. And Congresswoman Bachmann understands that point. As she said, and I've quoted her several times on my blog, when we got the vaccine for polio, we stopped spending money on polio. It's sort of self-evident, but I think the challenge is that such a focus on science and medicine undercuts the kind of fiscal, bureaucratic, policy wonk monopoly of thinking in Washington, and I guess in policy circles around the country, where it says, oh, no, whatever the problem is, there's a fiscal solution for it. This is what gave us Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, as well as Obamacare.
I think another interesting facet to this discussion is, the way I look at it, the U.S. is the leader in biomedical innovation, but I find it ironic that we don't find much of that conversation in Washington, D.C. We talk about, you know, clean energy technologies and racing ahead in the same areas that the Chinese and other countries are, or the president going to, quote-unquote, bail out the automotive industry. A lot of people make cars. A lot of people are trying to make solar panels and other types of, you know, quote-unquote, clean, green energy components. But the U.S. is the leader in biomedical innovation. This is a field in which we're already head and shoulders above the global community, but I don't think anybody thinks that the U.S. biomedical enterprise is running in top gear right now. So you'd think that it would be natural for people to focus on getting or enlarging a lead or improving the system we've got now. We've already got a comparative advantage.
Exactly. Look, some industries go in and out of fashion. Green technology, which to me is mostly a hoax in terms of its actual economic applications, is very in right now and has been for the last 5 years or longer. And so the politicians, mostly Democrats, are looking for ways to add tax subsidies and tax credits and rejigger the entire utility electrical system to somehow make solar and wind viable, which I think they'll still fail. And of course, the cap and trade was this major attack on the productive economy. And there's a great illustration right there, cap and trade. Oh, well, you know, we don't need industry and heavy industry. That's bad. What we really need is this new financial scam of cap and trade. And so in that upping and downing of who industries and technologies that seem cool, interesting, and others seem retro and bad, the pharmaceutical industry, for reasons I really can't accept, if I can sort of understand them in terms of where the politics has been, is hated. And the idea that the pharma industry and medical research in general could be a sort of a national champion, an engine of economic growth, not only of health providing therapies and treatments here at home, but also creating jobs, as you were getting at, and also exports, which would create more jobs. One of the realities of the current world is that, you know, the rest, as China and India and other countries become more prosperous, they are starting to develop the same disease profiles as we are. They're not dying of starvation anymore. They're dying of diabetes and all the other things that come from prosperous but also sedentary lifestyle. They're a natural customer for our products. If we had a president and a U.S. trade representative and a Congress that was oriented towards saying, gee, how can we help these guys create more stuff to keep us alive longer and support more of the same, the rest of the world wants the same things we do in terms of longer and better life.
Health is a growth industry simply because we're not going to stop aging or dying anytime soon. And that leads me to another part of the conversation There was a meeting, I think it might still be ongoing, it may have ended recently, the ASCO meeting, the American Society of Clinical Oncology in Chicago last week, and the president, George Sledge, gave a speech about the potential progress through new genomic technologies, the ability to look into the genetic roots of cancer and cancer cells. And it was a very sobering but hopeful speech. But he was saying that, look, we're discovering that really tumors within an individual patient will have different genetic profiles because at the root of cancer is genomic chaos. The disease mutates as it goes. It makes it much more like a virus in terms of trying to fight it than you know, traditionally think of one thing that we call breast cancer or one thing that we call lung cancer. Really, it's a very complex, multifaceted disease. But he said we need to turn information or turn this chaos into information very quickly. We need to think differently about how we test drugs, how we share information. I think that's the very kind of project, call it an Apollo moonshot-like effort on cancer, that you could make in terms of, you know, realistically focusing on what are going to be the key drivers of taking, which is really just reams of information, just enormous amounts of information, and turning it into the kind of knowledge that's usable for physicians and drug companies.
Yeah, Paul, your emphasis on the information part is critical because, look, we'll eventually find out that sort of everything that we do is subsumed within information. I mean, it's all, you know, just sort of a cliche to say it that way, but I mean, the internet and so on is going to just make it possible for every problem to get worked out and solved within this context, this matrix of information. And so, yes, the opportunity to use, you know, Google, and I don't mean the company, I just mean the larger, you know, semantic web and so on, as a way of analyzing the dozens and dozens, maybe hundreds, maybe thousands of kinds of cancer that we're now realizing are upon us. It's terribly hopeful in terms of figuring this out. It's also terribly interesting and vivid to people. And people will say, gee whiz, that's interesting news. That's an interesting political agenda if politicians could ever get it through their heads that people are just as interested or frankly more interested in life itself than health insurance. Instead, the debate, and so the kind of fascinating, rich, textured discussion that they're having out in Chicago and that are happening in another 100 medical facilities around the country and around the world is pretty much ignored by the political class who devoted themselves to a bunch of bean counters who would say, look, this is all interesting about what's going on at ASCO and stuff like that, but the Congressional Budget Office can't score it.
Right.
So it's not really, it's nice that it's happening, but it's not really relevant to anything that's going on as Paul Ryan dukes it out with Barack Obama on the budget in 2050 because the CBO can't score. Now, of course, the fact is that if one-tenth of the stuff that was discussed at ASCO or any other conference like that were actually to work out, and, you know, science is always hit and miss. I mean, you know, you just keep trying. Then the entire curve of Medicare and Medicaid and, you know, private health insurance would be transformed. And you can start to say, well, gee whiz, people are living longer. We figure some things out. Now let's raise retirement age. And all of a sudden, the entire budget battle over Medicare and also Social Security just goes out the window in a good way. We just don't have that problem anymore. But this stuff just doesn't fit into the very narrow box of thinking that Washington and sort of satellites of Washington can consider to be, quote, serious. It's too speculative. It's too sci-fi-ish, and therefore it happens completely unbeknownst in Washington. Look, if you'd gone back 30 years, this Congressional Budget Office began in 1975, and you went back and looked at some CBO report from 1980 or 85 or something like that, there wouldn't have been a word about Silicon Valley and computers and technology. They had no idea. No, very few of us did. It's not that they're uniquely stupid. It just means that they just don't make room in their minds for scoring this kind of potential or for even allowing it to happen. And if CBO doesn't score it, we've got this sort of false idol here in Washington called the budget office. And so therefore, every sort of hard-headed policy type in Washington ignores it.
But in terms of having a constituency or an event that changes Washington's focus, not just to arguing over the cost of care or how we structure insurance programs, but to focusing on bringing new cures to market in the fastest, most effective way we can, are there any events, things you see on the horizon that would shift the debate in that direction?
Well, two things. One would be a genuine financial crack-up. If the Republicans are dug in on no tax increase and the Democrats are dug in on no Medicare cuts, and that appears to be the takeaway from the New York 26 race, I think the Democrats certainly feel that they won the election there based on New York 26, and I think it's kind of hard to argue with them, frankly. And then they're going to have no give on either side. Grover Norquist is not going to give on taxes, and Nancy Pelosi is not going to give on spending. So out of that crisis, if there's anything left in the treasure chest, it's the Pandora of hope and transformation. That's sort of the negative way of putting it. The positive way of putting it is, I think this is where Michelle Bachmann and others, but frankly mostly her, are going to take the message of the people saying, look, as you said in your opening intro, Paul, you know, this is, let's get beyond this dull, dry, green eye shade, bean counting, and no hope equation of let's just take sick people and tell them they're only going to get two meals a day instead of three. Let's actually talk about not letting them be sick anymore. This is what we did. This is how cities became habitable. Cities weren't a net population gainer for the countries until probably about the turn of the 20th century from the 19th. Because until then, tuberculosis and pneumonia and every other kind of contagious disease were killing people faster than they were being born. So the only population that growth came from immigration. You'd go to the city, and to kind of put it bluntly, chances are you'd die. You know, you went for lots of reasons, but you would die younger than you were out in the countryside. Only beginning around 1900, thanks to the public health advances of the progressives of that era, did we start taking sewage and sanitation and those kind of public health measures seriously. And that added a decade easily to the lifespan of everybody, including the productive lifespan of people. You wouldn't have half your children dying as infants anymore. You wouldn't have workers dying when they're 40. And you'd have people living from 70 to 80, which is in the long run a good thing in terms of culture transmission, in terms of proper, family values and so on, just to have grandparents around to transmit knowledge to people. All those benefits came from somebody saying, look, we're not just going to take it as a given that people die when they're 40.
So revolutions that come on quiet feet, and you don't really you recognize that there's been a revolution that has totally changed our way of thinking. And in a way, you can say that Medicare and Social Security have changed our entire complexion of old age. That people are now thankfully playing golf and living full and rich lives well into their 70s and even in some cases 80s and beyond. And that's something to be thankful for. But we can push the curve even beyond that.
We can. And the example I always use is, again, back to this foolishness of trying to predict the deficit in 2050. Is, imagine what would have happened in 1970, 40 years ago, if somebody had said, the telephone costs too much. Ma Bell is ripping us off. And so those phone calls that you make from a payphone with a cord and a dial, not a push button, but a dial, shouldn't be 10 cents, they should be 9 cents. You could have gotten a lot of support for that. People said, yeah, I want to save that penny on every phone call and so on. And then we'd have sort of set in, the independent payment advisory telephone board, the telephone equivalent of IPAB, this idiotic thing that's in the Obama administration that's going to destroy drug creation and research and development of the pharma industry even more. And we would have had that, and we'd be paying 9 cents for a phone call. And of course, over the coming decades, as those 9 cent calls came in, phones would get scarce and there would be no innovation. You and I couldn't possibly be having this podcast conversation because the technology wouldn't exist for it. And 40 years later, we say, well, gee, but the good news is we're only paying 9 cents for a phone call. And we'd never know that we'd given up not only the enormous revolution of telephony, but also a good chunk of the computer internet stuff never would have happened either in the absence of all this telephone access. And so instead, fortunately, mercifully, we didn't have this sort of heavy political bureaucratic overlay on top of the telephone system. We just simply went with innovation and technology with a fair amount of government help in terms of, the integrated circuit, the transistor, and DARPANET, later ARPANET, later the internet. So there's a lot of very productive sort of Hamiltonian fusion there. But the result is what we have now, which is the phone call isn't 10 cents or one penny cheaper. It's 99.9% cheaper. And there's a million different kinds of phones, and they're portable, and they do all these other things and so on. That's the kind of potential that we could have in anything that involves, going back to your point about information, if it's a matter of algorithms and data and data crunching, then you can crunch medicine just as easily as you can crunch silicon. But you have to have the entrepreneurial, free market, but also structured environment to make that possible.
And I think that's a terrific note to end on. The revolution of the cell phone and later the iPad, we're spending more on these devices, but we're equally happy that we are, and they're adding more value and productivity to our lives. Medicine, of course, has the possibility to do far, far more than the iPad, but the similar linking of information through technology and then turning into usable products and new innovations to cure diseases is the same direction we want to go. Jim, thanks very much for spending some time with us today.
Thank you, Paul.